The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Sinead O'Connor's on the front of The Guardian today. And as you might know, Sinead has written a memoir. It's called Rememberings, and it's a terrific book. And I went out to Sinead's house to talk to her the other night, and I went out with my little piece of paper with all my questions about the book. But of course, that's not quite how it went. Sinead O'Connor, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. Very good. How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
Good.
So you've a new book, Rememberings, and it's fantastic. Now, it's not really an autobiography. I don't know, would you call it a memoir? I think a lot of people were afraid it was going to be an autobiography and that everything would be in it.
I'd say there were a few
nervous people.
No, I couldn't remember. I wouldn't have been able to remember enough to write it. And anyway, no, it's a memoir. And why it's called Remembrance is really, it's little snapshots. It's almost written in the form of blogs, a lot of them in the present tense, but it's just snapshots of memories. Do you know what I mean? The same way a memory works. But my number one object was, in fact, not to be saying anything in the book that would worry anyone. You know, I knew there'd be lots of people worrying, you know, I might write. But I didn't write anything about romantic relationships or, you know, people who are assholes other than myself. Do you know what I'm saying? I didn't want it to be that type of book. It was number one instructions to the publisher was, you know, make sure nobody's, I haven't said anything bad about anybody, do you know?
Yeah.
Except maybe Dr. Phil. And
there's a couple more as well. We maybe come to that.
Maybe
come
not.
Here, doesn't it feel, it feels a bit like though everyone's kind of having a Sinead O'Connor moment. It's been really well received and a lot of people kind of going, oh my God, yeah, we love Sinead O'Connor. Does it feel good?
Well, you see, I don't really pay attention. Like, do you know, I never, over the years, once I got past my first album, I stopped reading reviews, good or bad, or, you know, stopped reading about myself, good or bad, you know. I did, obviously, on Saturday, because it was unusual for me, and a dream come true, because I secretly always wanted to be a journalist, actually, or a writer, and, you know. I did my work experience at the Irish Times, you know, when I was 16. So I did on Saturday watch a lot of what was going on with the first piece that the Irish Times ran.
Yeah.
And that was great. You know, I was really pleased, particularly with the comments. It mattered to me that people would talk about the writing. Because outside of Ireland, all anyone's asking me about is, you know, oh, Saturday Night Live this and all, whatever, you know, the national anthem and blah, 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 and misery and pain and blah, blah, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas in Ireland, people be talking about the writing, and I really like that, you know, because we're a country of writers, you know. So I was really pleased that there was all these lovely posts from what I might call fellow journalists now, you know, saying that they really liked the writing. That really made me happy, you know. But otherwise, I haven't engaged. All I ever watch is American CNN all day long or Netflix. And I couldn't tell you what's going on in this country at all. I never listen to the radio, watch the telly, nothing.
Really? So, have you done that for your own kind of peace of mind? Just switched off?
No, do you know, I got fed up hearing the same songs on the radio all the time.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same songs they were playing when I was 10. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I get fed up with that. Do you know, like,
you've heard it all now.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know,
so you've heard enough.
I'm joking.
Afford to zone out.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm joking really, but it's more. I spend a lot of my life living in America, and I feel like I should have been born there. I think like my stork got drunk here on the way, and lost me. You know.
Yeah.
But I was supposed to end up in America. I love America, and obviously the sort of catastrophe of Trump was irresistible, and I was in America when he first came down the elevator and declared his whatever, you know. So I've been glued to CNN, nothing but American CNN since then.
Yeah.
Watching the devil at work, you know.
So you think you should have been American? Would you have been a different person then, do you think, if you were American?
I probably would have been the same. Who knows? We can only speculate. But I don't. People often ask me, do I think I would be different if, you know, I'd grown up in the little house in the prairie or something or blah, 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 you know. But
yeah.
No, I think you'd be essentially the same person, you know. So.
Yeah.
But I do, but wish, do you think, I wish do, I had like, been born in Southern California. Like.
Yeah, don't we all? Yeah.
Exactly.
But in a way, like, do you think that was Ireland oppressive for you at times and stuff, and was growing up here oppressive for you?
No, it was just bloody freezing.
What?
It was just freezing.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't find it oppressive. I was lucky in that I could observe the darkness that that was there, you know, without being emotionally affected by it too much. Catholicism, for example, and the theocracy, I could see all the darkness in it, but I was like a sponge that only was able to soak up the good. It didn't get into me, you know. And then, but I suppose the only time I can remember things not being oppressive for me, but being quite dark, was the hunger strikes, you know.
Yeah.
That time around the Republic of Ireland, never mind the awfulness that was going on up the north, but to be a child or young adolescent at that time was sad, really. The men were all walking around looking sad, even in the Republic. Everybody, the men were all a bit cowed, you know, physically, and everybody was a bit depressed, you know. And, of course, it was all graffiti, and people would write. Remember in Black Rock, somebody had written Free Bobby Sands with every box of cornflakes.
Yeah, I remember.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just a miserable time, and obviously watching everything going on up the north, you'd be watching it on telly because people didn't have the sense in those days to turn the telly off if something was inappropriate for young people to watch, you know.
Yeah.
The news would
yeah.
be on all day on the radio or the thing, you know.
So we soaked all that up.
Yeah, you know, watching fire. Yeah. I remember particularly things like Christmas Eve, when you'd be a small child, you'd be on the telly would be Israel. They were all blowing each other up in Jesus' birthplace.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
you're thinking, how can anywhere in the world be okay if that's happening on Christmas Eve in Jesus' birthplace, you know? But the same, and yeah, we all, I'm sure, took on, you know, everything. We only saw the war on telly. You know, so thanks be to God, we have no idea what it was like for either side to be living like that, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was
going
hellish.
Back to the writing, yeah. So do you think, is this something new that you found to write in this kind of form instead of writing songs? Do you think this could be something you might pursue now?
I actually always had a bit of a thing for being a journalist. I did my work experience at the Irish Times, and I had a yearn to be a journalist, you know, so... This week I did manage to attain a job with an Irish newspaper, so I'm going to be a columnist for this particular newspaper, which is something I've always wanted to do.
Okay. And, which newspaper is it?
Well, I better not say in case I haven't asked them if it's okay for me to say, you know, so.
Okay.
But, I'm good at writing in the blog form because what I'm used to is writing 3-minute songs.
Yeah.
And that way you get very good at editing, you know.
Yeah.
But also it means my forte would be short bursts. I don't think I'd be very good at, you know, I wouldn't have been good at writing an autobiography, for example, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think I'd be very good at writing like colour pieces or interviewing people or writing long or political or shit like that. So I think the blog form is something I continue. I wouldn't write a book again if you paid me £1 million. Well,
was it hard?
Maybe if you paid me £1 million. But no, the writing was easy. What I didn't like, I suppose, was the editing. You know, the editing process takes so long, you know, and it's a lot of hard work and I'm lazy.
Yeah.
Again,
yeah.
I'm used to dealing with 3 minutes. Do you know what I mean?
And yeah.
You do your job, you write the song, you go in, you sing it, it takes 3 minutes. It's all over. Somebody else is worrying about it then, you know.
So did you get the same fulfillment out of this as you do from music? Like the way, you know, the way people, this book, I think, is potentially a book that's going to mean a lot to a lot of people. If you look at even the reaction that your piece in the Irish Times got.
I hope so. I like what in the book talks about the Ireland that the young people of Ireland can't imagine. The Ireland that we grew up in,
yeah.
the theocracy. These no internet, and only the woman down the road had a phone, and you'd ring her house and somebody would run up the road and get your mother, you know,
yeah,
if you're away in Australia. I quite like that there's perhaps a generation of people who get to... I hope excuse me if I try to find words for a while. The fact that I'm a songwriter, it means that I'm used to putting... I have to make you feel the thing. I have to make you almost be able to touch it and smell it and taste it, you know?
Mm.
Which is different sometimes when you're writing prose. So I hope that I manage to convey in that way. I tried to make the first half of the book like songs. I tried to approach them the same way, make them a bit poetic and a bit mystical or whatever. I can't find the right word, but... that some of them might hypnotise you a bit down the road, like a Pied Piper, do you know?
Yeah.
But in
yeah.
particular, yeah, I would like if people in their 20s and teenagers and all who are growing up here had a picture, or not just a picture, but were able to be there and feel it, like, do you know?
Yeah.
And I think being a songwriter, that's your job, to make people be there and feel it.
Was it hard going back into a lot of the memories, you know, they're not all rosy. Was that difficult?
Well, no, that's funny. I mean, let's laugh. Let's laugh about it. That's an understatement. But yeah, no, obviously, you know, but there is, the book is also funny, you know. I don't want, you know, English media, they love to kind of make you out to be a bit miserable and tragedize everything, you know. And it's not like that. The book's quite funny as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are some painful memories. But no, you know what? People keep asking me, was it cathartic? And my thing is, I had already done the catharsis with songs and sound.
Yeah.
Not even just words, but sound. And I had been around the world screaming into microphones for 40 years before I wrote the book. So the catharsis was already done. But I was frightened to read the audiobook and even, in fact, to read the edits properly. Do you know what I mean? I used to send it back to the dude and say, oh, yeah, it's grand, I read it, because I was afraid if I read it, it would take me back. When I was writing it, it didn't, because I was writing songs, as far as I was concerned.
And you're just in it.
Yeah, it was all woo-woo, a whole other world. But then, yeah, I was frightened of the editing process.
And then, you had to read it out loud yourself for the audiobook.
No, I was afraid to do that. I tried to get out of reading the audiobook because I thought it would transport me back, you know, to bad memories. But it didn't, weirdly. In fact, the only thing that I got very emotional about, I had to take a couple of days off, was the Prince chapter, because I hadn't engaged with that emotionally at the time.
Yeah.
But then I did find...
And it's funny, about the Prince story, like, you do write it in a funny way.
Yeah.
But obviously it brought up kind of trauma for
you. I didn't realise until I read it what an absolutely frightening situation I had been in as a 22-year-old woman.
You're 22.
In the middle of bloody nowhere, in a man's house, you know, with no address, nobody knows I'm there, everybody thinks I'm grand. Do you know, Steve Farnoli even wouldn't have known where this man lived. Do you know what I'm saying?
This was your manager, who was also...
Well, they were at court with each other because Steve had been Prince's manager and allegedly Prince hadn't paid him or whatever, and there was a court battle going on.
So Prince summoned you to the house. Will you tell us the story?
The thing is, I think I tell it better in the book than I could tell it on the radio. I think it's the best chapter in the book, actually.
It is, but give us a little bit.
I'd really rather surprise people. I really would.
Okay.
I really would.
Okay.
But to continue the previous question about, was it emotional going back? I was just talking to my manager there about how, you know, a gig is emotionally going back. The songs are all about the past. You have to, as a bel canto singer, deliver them emotionally. So you've got to engage emotionally. Do you know what I mean? And that can be tricky. But yeah, I didn't find writing the book or reading the book emotional. But weirdly, a guy in the UK about 2 weeks ago, he wouldn't shut up about my mother and abuse and all. And that did my head in, actually. They had all been asked not to bring up the subject of abuse.
Yeah.
Because it's different for the person who's been through a trauma. If they choose to bring it up, that's fine. But you're like, I'm not going to come around your house and say, hey, do you remember that time that bashed you across the head?
Yeah.
Or whatever, you know. So there was...
If you put it in the book, you're in control of that and you own it.
But yeah.
You don't like people then.
I don't like to go there.
Perform this.
Again, I've written it like songs. A songwriter, the reason that you have music is, or rather, if you could describe music, you wouldn't need it. Right. And if the reason we have music is because there sometimes are no words.
Yeah.
Right? So when I was writing even the pieces about those bad things, I did it the same way I would as a songwriter. So it's an emotional detachment. See, when you see me singing and I close my eyes and I've gone off into another world, that's because if I can't afford to fully emotionally engage, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or I wouldn't be able to sing the song. I'd be crying.
That's why I hate singing at funerals. And the stage in front of people.
That's why I don't like singing at funerals, because you can't cry and sing at the same time.
Yeah.
But so I had never gone there emotionally. So it was a blessing in disguise in a way, because for years, therapists and all have been saying to me, oh, but you're talking and you're not expressing any emotions. You've dissociated yourself. So this completely dug up all the sleeping dogs, you know. And in a way, it was a blessing in disguise, but it was painful. I didn't really like him doing it, to be fair. But it was a blessing in disguise, because actually I went back there for the first time in my life. I actually did emotionally engage.
That was the first time you've done that?
Yeah, since I was a kid, like. And it was great. It was a great thing to do. That was a catharsis, even though it was horrible and I pulled all the remaining promo and I wasn't going anywhere near any of it. you know. But I just sat here for the whole that weekend like an 11-year-old child. I was 11, you know, and I just howled. And it was great because I never had, you can't howl at the time. You're too busy surviving it, do you know. So it's a blessing in disguise. But
were you alone?
Oh, yeah, but I don't mind. I love being on my own. So I have good friends, though, that I can ring, you know.
Yeah.
So obviously,
but you went through this on your own.
Well, no, I have the support of St. Pat's. I'm always on. They have a thing which is called a home care package, so that you can almost permanently be a patient if you want, or dip in and out, you know.
Yeah.
And you always, even when you're not officially either in hospital or on the home care package, you still have the support of your team. So that was great because I had the support of my professor Lucy, Jim Lucy, is my doctor in there, and also an amazing other doctor that he works with called Basil Matty. So I was sensible enough to write to them on the Monday and say, this dude's after my head up here, would you ring me? I can't stop crying, do you know?
Yeah.
And so they rang me. So they've been supporting me through it. The doctor's attitude was, thanks be to God, pretty much. Like, everybody's trying to get you to feel it for years. Do you know what I mean? And so he said, just sit with it and be with it. He said, it's a new way of feeling. Because I was nearly running back into paths over it, do you know?
Yeah.
Because, of course, you'd do anything to avoid feeling that, do you know? Because it's not pretty.
So you went through it?
Oh, yeah, I went through it, thanks be to God. And here, you see, I have on this glass here what Professor Lucy said to me, you know, instead of going running into hospital, he says, a new way of feeling. You're going to feel. You just sit and feel it and you'll get through it and realise that it's a blessing in disguise.
Yeah. And have you spent a lot of time there in the last
6 years? 6 years on and off, I've spent more time there than I have out of there, yeah. So,
and is it hard being in a place like that?
No, you know, it's just like being in the music business. It's like being on tour. It's like being on tour. Everybody, it's been beautiful, to be honest, because like you meet, there's an awful, as you know, stigma about people with mental illnesses, and it comes from lack of education, do you know?
That's very hard. And
people act like you're somehow to be feared, you know, like you're going to leap on them any second. Do you know what I mean? And nothing could be further from the truth.
In fact, I would suggest that
anybody should go into St. Pat's, pretend you're bonkers, go in there and get to know all of these people with these conditions, and you find there's nothing further from the truth. These people are the gentlest, softest, most sensitive of us all.
Yeah.
You know? That's why they're there. They're sensitive, soft people, do you know? So
it is society and the expectations makes life even harder for them. Do people treat you like that?
Yep.
Yeah?
Absolutely.
Even though you're Sinead O'Connor?
Absolutely. Because I'm Sinead O'Connor.
Okay. You know? But let's face it, anyone who's not like Sinead O'Connor has no hope then.
Exactly. Yeah. Precisely. And like the American publisher rang me there a couple of months ago. He says to me at some big TV network in America, they're considering having me on the show, but they wanted to do a pre-interview with my publisher so they could make sure I didn't come across whack, in inverted commas. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But anyway, no, being in the hospital is exactly like being on tour, basically. You're dealing with the same kind of people, you know.
So, are you making any music?
I am. I've got an album coming out in January. So, yeah, I've been writing songs and then recording with David Holmes up in Belfast.
Yeah,
so
cool.
We've got an album coming out in January.
So is it kind of electronica backing to it then?
No, not really. Look, Dave is very cinematic. It's quite cinematic would be the best way I could describe it, but not at all. No, it's not dancey, nothing like that, no. It's still Sinead O'Connor songs, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it's not like dance music, no. So.
The thing about your mother, in between all the other stuff, she and your dad, they gave you music, didn't they? And your mother, your mother was into really good music, wasn't she?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, there's a good chapter in the book about my mother's record collection.
Yeah,
and my mother was she trained in the Cordon Bleu chef school that used to be there at the top of O'Connell Street when you turn right onto Parnell Street. What's it called? Cahill Brewer Street.
Yeah.
There was a college there. My mother studied to be a chef. So usually the table would be covered in, you know, dinners and cakes and whatever, these beautiful creations, you know, but every evening then be cleared away, and in the morning would be spread across the table like a deck of cards, the record collection, you know.
Yeah.
And she did have some very eclectic tastes, yeah. And like my very earliest memory as a baby is John Lennon, listening to John Lennon. Because she had like an 8-track machine. She was obsessed with John Lennon, not so much the Beatles. But John Lennon, she was just completely obsessed. She had every John Lennon record, you know. And so those were playing all the time, you know.
And then your dad in a different way kind of gave
my dad
music.
Was more the classical music kind of type, you know. Cello, you know, my father used to love cello. When that die, I love cello music as well, it's nice. But he used to listen to a guy called Boccherini, and we used to always get in trouble for calling him Knickerbockerini. You know? My dad would kill us, he'd be playing it in the car, I'd be like, Knickerbockerini, and he'd go mad. But my dad is a lover of songs. The two of them were amateur singers. They used to sing in terrible light operas, you know, like HMS Pinafore and shit like that.
Oh, did they? Yeah.
But so the two of them were avid singers, really. And my father, to this day, has singing lessons. You know, he's all his life gone to singing lessons, which is how I met my singing teacher, Frank Merriman, you know.
Yeah.
The two of them used to be getting drunk every Friday after the lessons, you know. So my father's always been mad about songs. My mother was more mad about voices, you know.
Yeah.
She wouldn't be necessarily hung up on the lyrics, you know.
Okay, the sound.
Loved John McCormick, who I bloody hated. For many is the reason, do you know?
So did you connect with the mother? The music was a kind of a healthy connection in some way with her then, was it?
Well, I don't know. I've never really thought about it. I suppose it was. I know that she definitely found it very soothing for me to sing. Particularly, she liked me to sing Don't Cry For Me, Argentina.
Yeah.
I think...
That was her. That's why you sing that song, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. And I got a letter from Tim Rice once, and he said that I sang it better than anyone he thought sang
it. I think you do, yeah.
I was really pleased with that, you know?
And then Scarlet Ribbons is from the dad.
Yeah. Well, loads of songs are from my dad. That's what I'm saying. She more liked the sound of voices like John McCormick and that. Sure, you couldn't make out a word he was saying. But he loved songs and lyrics and poetry. Like, my father's mad into poetry, you know, scriptures. He loves words. He's the person that the love of words would come from in myself and my sister and my brother, you know.
Yeah.
And my little brother also, you know.
And then, so his singing teacher, Frank Merriman, that was the bel canto. And that's that thing of, it's method acting kind of, is it?
Stanislavski method of singing,
you go into the place.
Yeah. So like Maria Callas would be the epitome of bel canto singing. So I don't know if you've ever watched her singing, but she's just full of fire and telling the story, you know. So it's not about the notes or scales. We don't learn notes or scales. You know, it's all about the emotions. So Frank's mantra would be, the emotions will take you to the notes.
Yeah.
So like if fire went off in here right now, you could scream fire at the highest octave there is, right? Because there really is a fire. But if there wasn't a fire and you tried to sing that note, you'd never get there.
Okay.
So it's all about using your emotions. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is, as I say, perfect for people with a borderline condition whose emotions are a bit large for the regular world.
Yes.
You know, so people like
that. So you are the opera, basically.
You are the song.
You're the song.
Yeah. You are the song. And that's what you see when you watch Maria Callas. You know, even in her eyes, she's got this fire burning. She is the song. Like,
and of course,
same way that Chuck Berry was the guitar. There was no difference when you watch Chuck Berry moving and everything with his guitar. Not the stupid penguin move, duck walk thing, but generally the way he is with the guitar. He's like a rider on a horse. You know, a good rider. You can't tell the difference between the rider and the horse. Same with Chuck Berry with the guitar. The way he moved with it was part of him. You know.
Yeah.
Same with bel canto singers. You know.
Yeah, I saw you said somewhere recently there about that there's always men crying at your gigs.
Yeah.
Like, there's obviously something in the tone of voice or something that you're hitting them somewhere, is there?
Well, there's always one point where they start crying, and it's about three quarters of the way through the show when we do a song of mine called Thank You For Hearing Me.
Yeah.
And it's not sad crying because it's not a sad song. It's almost an ecstatic song, you know. It's like a mantra. It's... religious is the wrong word. It's an ecstatic type of a mantra, you know. And as it gets to about halfway through, it seems to just unlock something, particularly in the men. The band tell me, because my eyes are closed, I haven't a clue, they tell me the women to be crying, but you hear the men howling from the back of the room, you know. But it's not sad crying. It's just that the song is almost religious. It opens up something in them that's just... Do you know?
And of course it has that kind of repetitive groove to it.
Yeah, but then different things get added in each verse or whatever. So by the time you get into the last few verses, it's whipped you up into an ecstasy, hopefully. It's a bit like a whirling dervish escapade, you know?
Yeah.
So it's quite prayerful. It's a prayerful song. That's really what it is. And then, I love when the fellas tell me they've been crying. Then I know I did a good job, do you know? Yeah. But you'd hear them like literally, whoa, at the back of the room. But the song that people go most mental over isn't even Nothing Compares to You. It's Black Boys on Mopeds.
Is it? Why?
Yeah. Every time I say the words Margaret Thatcher on TV, the place goes nuts.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter where the hell you are. Obviously, mostly in England.
Yeah.
Do you know, people just go nuts over that song. In America, they love that song because it's very sadly still an issue.
Yeah.
You know, the whole idea of cops killing black people, you know.
Is it funny that for a lot of people who might know all your stuff, that Nothing Compares to You is kind of your signature song when it's not your song, and the guy who did it, you had that awful experience with, and done all this other stuff.
Well, you know, it is my song.
Is how
I feel about it.
Yeah.
And I love it. And I don't sing songs. One of the first rules of bel canto is you wouldn't sing a song that you don't emotionally identify with. What's the point, you know? So I wouldn't be performing it if I didn't love it and emotionally identify with it. It's a song everybody can identify
and
with.
And you actually, you say in the book, it's that you're with your mother when
yeah,
when
in a good
it.
Way. That's the time that I think of my mum, you know, which in a nice way. So I like that. Or sometimes, like, say, given I'm using the Stanislavski method over the years, like after 30 years of singing it, I kind of ran out of things I could use, sensory experiences from the past and everything for the method acting of it.
Yeah.
You know? So sometimes what I'll do is I'll imagine I'm singing it to that I'm somebody else singing it to somebody else to play the character. Because that's how I see the songs, they're characters. Whether they're autobiographical or not is beside the point, but you're playing a different character every 3 minutes, do you know?
Yeah.
So you've got to find different things to make you cry, like actors do, or different things to, do you know? So it's quite the emotional work.
You're just using everything, like, yeah.
Or like I might imagine, you know, in my head I'm singing it to George Floyd. Or even I'm singing into Prince, perhaps. Do you know what I mean? Or things like that I would do, you know. But it doesn't bother me that it's him. And I don't hate him. I mean, I didn't like him. I think he was an awful devil. I really do. But, you know, at the same time, I feel sorry for him. I wept buckets when he died over the loneliness of his death, you know.
Yeah.
Because, like, where are his mates? And where are the mates when he's taking all these drugs, you know? And then they used Let's Go Crazy last year to advertise some American credit card. That would have made him turn his grave. Like, that song is about valuing friendship and everything. It talks about the world's about to end and let's all have a laugh and have a party. And it's all about friendship and love and fun. It's not about commercial, you know.
Yeah.
So I felt sorry for him, really, for that. But no, I never think of him when I'm singing Nothing About It. I don't think of him at all.
And that song did kind of change your life and put it on another complete trajectory of like a kind of fame that you probably weren't cut out for, were you?
No, well, I was too young, and no, I wasn't. I wouldn't be cut out for it anyway, do you know, like for loads of reasons. Like, I don't know, I came from punk. I mean, I grew up in the 70s, all the artists were real spiritualized. After John Lennon dies for 10 years, there's nothing real about music. Synthesizers, fake guitars, fake drums, lyrics about nothing, all about hairdos, do you know?
Yeah.
But I grew up in a time where the artists were spiritualized and not politicized, but they saw themselves as opposites of politics, do you know? They wouldn't
so
be seen dead
in
Downing Street.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Were you uncomfortable then when you were catapulted into kind of mainstream America, MTV kind of scene?
Yeah, I really was. I was embarrassed. I was shy and embarrassed, and I found it really embarrassing, do you know? I also had kind of imposter syndrome, and I didn't like the whole get. As a pop star, you spend more time getting your picture took than making music.
Yeah.
It's all about how you look and la la la. It was boring. I wasn't cut out for it. And you have to be real well behaved. And
was there something in you subconsciously that blew all that up?
Not subconsciously, consciously.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the tearing up of the picture of the Pope on Saturday Night Live that time, you knew you were blowing up your career.
I wasn't blowing up my career. As I said in the book, people say that me tearing up the picture derailed my career. But I feel, in fact, that what derailed my career was having a number one record, you know? So I was like a square peg in a round hole. I didn't belong in that world. And what I am is I'm a bel canto singer, which means I'm born for live performance. Mm. That's what I'm supposed to be doing, you know? And once I had done that, I'd ripped up the whole pop star career, but it meant I made my living then by performing live, which is what I was meant to do, and continue to make a very good living doing that, you know. So, you know, to me, success isn't about having all the money or having the good name or people liking you or any of that crap. It's, are you actually doing what you were born to do and being true to yourself, you know?
Yeah. So things had gone drastically wrong at that stage as far as you were concerned.
Yeah, you know, and like nobody, you know, also I had grown up in this Catholic country where it had really sank into me, this thing of rejecting the material world in favour of more spiritual things, you know. And I know this might sound bonkers, but like I was very religious growing up, you know, and I took terribly seriously the contract I signed when I made my Holy Communion, and also the contract I signed when I made my confirmation. And my attitude was I had to keep those contracts because I signed those way before I signed anything in the music business. Mm. Nothing in my music business contract said I had to abandon those contracts, the previous two contracts. So my object was, you know, to, when I say to keep true to those contracts, was from a child I wanted people to know by my music, music as a priesthood. That's why I like the Rastafari people and Bob Dylan and that, you know, and Van, you know, priests are people who very flawed. They have to be flawed by nature or people wouldn't identify with them, you know. But a priest is someone by whom you know there's a God, you know. And you certainly know that by Van and everything, you know. So my attitude was, you know, I'm not here to be a pop star and sing songs about, oh, baby, baby, and look pretty and be a good girl. I'm here to kind of move people and spiritually, do you know.
Yeah.
That I wanted to be a priest, musically speaking, do you know. And if a priest doesn't speak the truth, well, what's the point?
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So, and yeah, I couldn't be myself. I derailed my pop star career because I was a punk and a priest, you know. So you can't be a priest in the pop industry, you know. It's a very vampiric arena, you know.
Yeah, we're starting to look back now on how we treated celebrities and how pop stars were treated, and particularly female pop stars were treated. Mm. And, like, I guess was a lot of it taken for granted at the time, but like we look back now and we realize, okay, this is not a way to treat human beings. Like you were treated pretty badly by some of the people around you, weren't you?
Yeah, and but that's life, I guess. Look, I mean, what's the best way to put this? I suppose I was ahead of my time in certain ways. You know, like I was a 21st century woman in the 20th century, do you know? So, like, around the time 1985, 1987, when I leave Ireland in 1985, it's virtually unheard of for a woman to be making her own living and independent of men, either fathers or brothers or uncles or husbands, you know? So I was very lucky from 1985, I was making my own living, so that was different. I was looking how I wanted to look. And I think maybe sometimes people got annoyed because I was a bit like a mirror in which people saw all the no's they ever had to say. So many people in this country, women in particular, had to say no when they wanted to say yes to themselves. Do you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. They never got to say yes to themselves. That maybe they would have shaved their heads or dyed their hair blue, or, you know, had a nanny or a housekeeper, or, do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, babies with different men, or, do you know what I'm saying? Or be open about their anger. Do you know, in particular, at that time in Ireland, you couldn't be angry. Women weren't allowed to be angry.
Yeah.
You know, you could all beat each other up, the men, but we weren't allowed to be angry at all. You know, so I guess I was being all the things that a whole lot of people didn't get to be, mm-hmm. do you know? And I think that might have been hard for some of them because, you know, they had spent their whole life saying no to themselves, do you know?
And then as your commercial career progressed, the men who were managing you and record companies and all that, they wanted you to kind of be different, didn't they?
Well, they wanted me to grow the hair long and wear short skirts and high heels and makeup and the whole works, and pretty much write songs that wouldn't challenge anything. But then I come from a country where, you know, there used to be riots in the streets over plays, you know, like, so that's what art is for, you know.
Yeah.
That's what art is for, you know. That's why NWA were so brilliant. They were like the Beatles. They come along with the police and suddenly all the white kids are shouting the police. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And like there was riots in the streets over them. They were getting arrested from singing that, you know. So that's what music was for as far as I was concerned. I grew up with like the Sex Pistols and, you know, I'm sure you do too. Remember seeing the Sex Pistols on Top of the Pops? I can't even remember what, probably... What's the one? I'm getting old. I can't remember the name of songs anymore. They didn't get to do God Save the Queen on Top of the Pops, I don't think. Pretty Vacant, that's the one I'm thinking of, yeah.
I'm just too young. I was just too young for punk.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was a little bit too young, but Sex Pistols got through anyway, you know. So.
Okay, so listen, just before we start wrapping it up, it's kind of thinking, like, if you hadn't done all that, right, you'd have ended up, no, you'd be some mad diva playing Vegas or something like that over in America or whatever. And here you are. And as I was saying to you earlier, the whole world is fading you at the moment and the New York Times and all this. And you're kind of not hiding out, but you're up here in this cottage in the middle of nowhere. And have you ended up in the right place?
Yeah, definitely. I like my life now. I love it. That's why I have found promoing the book a little difficult, because I don't really like living in the past, because I have a lovely, content life now in the present. I never did really engage with the whole showbiz thing much anyway. Like, I don't go to the do's and I don't go to, you know, I don't bother. So, no, I don't relate to, what do you call it, Sinead O'Connor in inverted commas. You know, I know it's me, but it's also not. It's not the private me. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So I just don't really engage with it. I don't write. I don't look at things that people write very often, or, you know, I don't see myself in it.
I saw you tweeting that they should send you to the Eurovision.
I didn't. What I said was, I wondered why they never had.
Yeah.
Then, of course, all the newspapers misinterpret that and goes, Sinead wants to do the Eurovision. That's not what I actually said. But I don't know why they never did send me.
Yeah. Well, if they asked you now, would you go?
It would depend on the song. I'd go anywhere to sing a good song. Like, I'm a whore for songs. Do you know?
So you wouldn't write the song for them. You'd like someone to
write it. Either I would, or somebody else would. Do you know?
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind whether I wrote it or didn't. But I would go anywhere to sing a good song. You know.
Yeah. So will we see you out singing again soon?
Oh, yeah, I'm starting touring next year. Everything got cancelled last year and then was scheduled for this year and that got pulled. So we're doing it all next year from April. So
yeah. Are you excited about getting back out there?
Yeah. Definitely.
Do you still get that big buzz from performing? Is that's what you want to be doing?
Well, that's what I do, and it's also how I make my living. Yeah. You know? So I get a buzz out of being able to pay my electricity bill.
Yeah. You know? Did you burn through all the big money you made, yeah?
I didn't burn through it. Like, I made about 10 million quid. I gave away half of it.
Yeah.
Because I had promised a priest when I was a kid that I would pay back for
money
I had stolen, which is all in the book. And so I gave away half of it and was able to make money again by touring. So, you know, I was able to, you know, even after ripping up the Pope and the whole pop star thing, I was still able to feed my kids and school them and everything. I never had to ask a man for nothing. And that made me happy.
Yeah. But you need to work again now?
No, I like working. Do you know, I'd get bored. Do you know?
Yeah.
But also, I'm not stupid enough to think I'm not going to get old. There'll come a time, like, all of us now, because people don't pay for records, we can only make money touring. Do you know? And my kids are all grown up and everything, so I don't need to worry. But, like, singers are like football players. There'll come a time when I'm too old to be singing.